effective boom and skimming operation, which now employs over 39 skimmers and 200,000 feet of boom. One of the major challenges of the cleanup operation has been communication with the hundreds of seagoing vessels, planes, onshore cleanup crews, and research activities involved with both offshore and onshore cleanup activities. To meet this challenge, Exxon, the State of Alaska, the Coast Guard, and the Federal Aviation Administration have established a joint communications center, which will enable 24-hour communications throughout the Prince William Sound area. Communications will be established through a microwave link on Naked Island. The center is expected to be operational early next week. On the salvage, hull inspection on the Exxon Valdez continues at Outside Bay on Naked Island. Divers are surveying the outer shell and internal structure to determine the extent of necessary repairs. Until the structural survey is completed, the cost and timing of repairs is unknown. And as I say, John Tompkins will give you more details on that. On skimming and booming, the equipment from all around the U.S. and other countries continues to be shipped to Valdez to expand skimming and booming operations. Currently, 39 large skimmers suitable for heavy oil-water immersion are employed. Six skimmers are in Valdez being readied and 40 are en route. About half of the skimmers are deployed ahead of the slick. The remainder are deployed in the most strategically sensitive areas in Prince William Sound. Boom in the water totals 200,000 feet. An additional 32,500 feet has been deployed for use in Whittier, Cordova, Kodiak, and Valdez. Another 157,000 feet is en route. The protection of key environmentally sensitive areas remains one of the most important cleanup priorities. The massive booming and skimming operation continues in Sawmill Bay to protect the San Juan hatchery. A three-tiered effort of primary, secondary, and deflection boom has been established. Other significant areas include Herring Bay, Snug Harbor on the east side of Knight Island, Point Eleanor, and in the northern Knight Island area and around surrounding islands. Exxon has also sent boom equipment to Seward as a precautionary measure to protect Resurrection Bay, as well as to Homer and Kodiak Island. Excuse me. Shore cleanup activities are escalating. State and federal agencies agree that the first priority is to continue to fight the oil before it reaches shore. However, a phased onshore implementation plan has been approved, and the first phase of the plan will be underway shortly. A first priority will be to screen affected areas for historical or archaeological significance before cleanup crews are sent in. Exxon has already hired an archaeologist to begin conducting these surveys. We're starting in the Naked Island group. In addition, the Shoreline Cleanup Committee has identified periods of time when cleanup activities can occur without harming sensitive reproductive cycles for fish and mammals. The committee has also established a new list of cleanup priority areas. In addition to the crews on the east side of Naked Island, an additional 500 Alaskan local hires will be added to the onshore cleanup effort over the next 7 days. All hiring will be done through VECO, the local contractor, and new hires will have to undergo a safety and orientation program. Interested persons can contact VECO recruiting offices in Whittier, Seward, Cordova, English Bay, and Valdez. Exxon's response team totals approximately 450 persons, of which about 125 are Exxon employees, and the remainder are experts from throughout the U.S., Canada, and the United Kingdom. About 400 additional workers, both union and non-union, are employed in onshore and offshore cleanup, animal recovery, and other support activities. Well over 250 to 300 additional people are aboard the 110 vessels contracted to Exxon. Altogether, about 1,000 contract personnel are now working on the cleanup effort. Further employment of local hires will continue as the spill effort progresses. All manpower is on hand that can be effectively used at this time. The forward edge of the spill in the Gulf of Alaska, south of Nuka Bay, is no longer proceeding westerly and appears to be breaking up in open ocean. There appears to be less oil in Prince William Sound, with the major portion on the east side of Knight Island near Snug Harbor. The oil has largely moved away from McClure Bay, eliminating the likelihood of impact on the Nelly Wan Narrows. Exxon representatives have received and are processing around 400 claims requests in both the Valdez and Cordova offices. A variety of different means is available to meet both short and long-term claims needs. A $10 million fund has been established to provide immediate interest-free assistance to those who are not yet prepared to submit full claims, but who require monetary support. In addition, Exxon is prepared to provide partial claims to those partial claims settlement to those who have the potential to incur further damage at a later time. Full claims may, of course, be submitted and will be handled promptly. The Valdez Claims Office telephone number is 1-800-835-5406. And the Cordova number is 424-4202. At this time, a minimum of 18,000 barrels have been recovered from the surface of the water. Significant additional oil is included in skimmers and bladder tanks. Approximately 18,000 gallons were burned on March the 26th. Natural vaporization and dispersion reduced approximately 40% of the original spill in our estimation. The remainder appears to be split almost equally between Prince William Sound and the Gulf of Alaska and the shoreline, split three ways. Okay, that is my update, and now I'd like to call on John Tompkins to give you a little additional information on the ship salvage.
Good morning. What I'd like to do is, as Don said, give a little brief update, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have. As Don mentioned, we have moved the vessel over to Outside Bay, which is in the southwest corner of Megan Island, and that was done on Wednesday, and about Wednesday night, pretty late Wednesday night, we were able to secure the vessel and start our next phase of operation. That next phase was really in three areas. We're talking about two diving teams that had gone starting an underwater survey, and that group has completed that survey as of early this morning. The second phase was a one diving team locating cracks, vertical type cracks, that we were drilling in order to keep the cracks from spreading any further. They're still undertaking that activity. The third phase had to do with skimming the oil off of the cargo tanks, and we're in the process of doing that, and we're bringing that oil from the top of the cargo tanks into a secure tank, which in the future we'll put on a barge and move away from the ship. Today, what we're going to start doing is going back to some of the areas that are heavily damaged and do a little more detail activity as to making sure that everything is secure there, so we have a strong area when we get ready to move the vessel. That is, no free plates or nothing that's so-called flapping or hanging down. The second thing that we're going to do is also look at a little more detail some of the areas where we think we can temporarily repair, and we're undertaking that today. We should be able to complete that, I think, in about two to three days. We'll have a real good analysis of those particular areas. Today we're also beginning our kind of phase two, if you will, which is our analysis of what we have. Since we've just completed a survey, now we're looking to see, okay, how do we address these things? What's our best game plan? And that analysis ought to be completed sometime this week or in a few days. Our goal, of course, is to eventually prepare the vessel to go to sea and to bring her to a repair yard where we will completely repair the vessel. But to do that, we have some temporary repairs that we need to do here. That's about what I wanted to share with you, where we are at this moment. And I'm not sure, Don, if you want to answer questions about the salvage area first. I'd be happy to do that. Yes.
When do you expect that the vessel will be moved?
Well, that's very difficult to determine at this moment until we really have completed our analysis phase and established our game plan as to what we really need to do. I really be afraid to hazard a guess, because I'm really not sure what the things are going to be.
A couple of weeks or a couple of months?
I would say a couple of weeks or plus. It depends on how much it takes to do some of the kind of repair. But you certainly aren't We're just not sure at this moment. I think through the end of the week, I'll be able to give you a lot better assessment of that.
So at this point, how much residual oil is there still within the vessel, and is the weather that's developed over the last 12, 24 hours going to affect the movement of that residual oil at all? Is there any chance of any more coming out because of the weather?
Well, there's about anywhere between 15,000, a little bit more barrels of oil on board, 15 to 17, in my recollection, the last count. And those are mainly either in a secure tank or they're on the top 5 or 6 inches of some of the cargo tanks. We're skimming that oil off of those vessels now, or off of those tanks now. As far as any concern about oil getting out of the ship, I'm very confident that we won't have any of that oil getting away from us. It's got a huge water leg underneath it, and the weather is not affecting us. Of course, the weather's been great up until today, and it's still not affecting us, and we're confident that it won't affect us.
Thank you.
This is a live press briefing from the Valdez Civic Center. Here's Don Cornett, manager of Exxon Alaska Operations.
Okay, I have one gentleman in the back right there.
You're estimating 2,300 barrels a day. That really is about twice the estimate that everybody else has come up with. And just sort of judging by the fact that we're now at 1,800 barrels, that would sort of back that 1,000 barrel a day figure up.
Well, the number of skimmers went up. We're 39 skimmers now, and we've learned a little bit about some of these skimmers and how they work. I can't vouch for the number. It's what the operations people have on the board that says that's what they're averaging and what they expect to do a day. Yes?
Could you help me a little bit with the number of people you're hiring? I tried to get it from your statement, but I'm a little bit confused. Is it the total number of people that are non-Exxon employees that you have contracted local, and explain to me, if you would, approximately how much they're paid, what they're doing, whether most of them are locals or flying in here, could you?
Yes. Just start at the bottom and come up. They're local people, with the exception of the experts that we brought in from around the world to do specific tasks, the ones that we've been talking to you about all along. These laborers that are being put on are all local people. At least that's our instructions to the contractors. What they're being paid, a rate that's sort of competitive with the North Slope rates, and I think it's in the $16, $17 an hour range.
The total number of, one other question on that. When you employ them, it's completely your right, but are they asked to no longer speak to the press?
No.
They're free to speak to any news organization if they so choose while they're under your contract?
Yes.
Okay, and again, the total numbers of, you're instructing your contractors, if somebody's from California and said, boy, this is a great wage and I want to come up and take advantage of it, your contractors try not to hire that person and only stick with the local people?
Our contractors have been instructed very firmly about local hire. They're very familiar with the issue. They work here all the time, and they understand the sensitivity of local hire. I don't know if there's, if someone lives here and has grown up here and is in college at Stanford and comes back and gets a job, I don't know if they're local or not, but I suspect they probably qualify. But we have resisted many, many offers of volunteers or people to come up. Now, we've brought some people up for the bird rescue and mammal rescue centers who are specialists in their field, but and for the laborers, they are local, to my knowledge, completely.
I wonder if you could comment on some reports that came out over the weekend that Exxon was warned as early as 1985 that Captain Hazelwood had drinking problems. And
I can't comment on that, George. As I explained the other day, the spokesmanship for that issue has moved to the chairman of the board, and I really am charged with trying to get this job done that we're doing in Prince William Sound. I understand the reason for your question, but you really have to put it to the people in New York who are the spokesman for that now. There's a gentleman right behind you.
Prince William Sound, if I may follow up. When is Exxon going to begin using the high-pressure hoses, and are they coming in from France?
We have scoured the countryside in the U.S. I knew that there were some on the East Coast, but they're not nearly in the numbers. When they had the Cadiz spill, Amoco Cadiz spill in France, they used them extensively, and they built large numbers of them, hundreds of them. And yes, we've asked them to ship them in. And we will start using them when this committee that is directing the onshore cleanup says this is a spot where you can use them and the oil is off the water enough in this area that you can begin to clean the shoreline.
You have a general idea when that might happen?
I don't right now. I'll try to get you an answer to that.
Don, you said in your statement that all manpower is on hand that can be effectively used. What use to you, then, is the military help that's supposedly coming in?
The military is at the disposal of the Coast Guard, is the way the general put it this morning, I think, on the Today Show. And he said, we will do what the Coast Guard directs us and no more. And I don't know what the Coast Guard is having them do. I suspect that they're helping some. I think I've heard that there's a group of a company of construction battalion or CB people coming in to help build the Bird and Mail Rescue Center in Seward. But beyond that, it's mostly the logistical support, flying in additional equipment, and the things that they're good at.
But you don't need it for...
I'm sorry, gentlemen, right here.
What plan do you have, if any, to reimburse the U.S. military for any expenses it incurs in support of the spill?
I think we're anticipating that the costs that are incurred by governments at all levels that can be attributed to this spill will be eventually reimbursed by Exxon. Yes, sir.
Could you go back over that 40% figure that you mentioned about what's been evaporated and so forth, and how do you base that? What do you base that on? Does that mean that 40% of the spilled oil has actually been taken care of by nature and is no longer a threat?
That's right, and that's not unusual. You remember, if you're here in the early stages of this, I was guessing 25-35%. They've gone back and looked at the characteristics of the oil, the temperature of the water, and it's their best estimate now. I'll reread that. A minimum of 18,000 barrels have been recovered. Significant additional oil is included in skimmers and bladder tanks. Approximately 18,000 gallons were burned on March 26, which isn't very much. Natural vaporization and dispersion reduced approximately 40% of the original oil, and the remainder of it is divided between the Gulf, the Sound, and the shoreline.
That means you only have water about 60% of the original spill now?
Yes, that's not unusual. Yes.
Can you tell, how the change in the weather is specifically affecting your operations and what your estimates are of what it will do to the movement of the oil in the next 24 hours or so?
We're tracking the oil both in the Sound and in the Gulf twice daily, I believe. And the big factor, of course, is the wind. And the wind has been very good for us, with the exception of that one night it blew at 70 miles an hour when the oil was still in the Sound. It's my understanding that the winds today are still easterly, about 35 to 45 miles an hour in the Gulf. And that's very favorable. It tends to push the oil further out to sea. And also, as it whips up the waves, the energy of the waves work very much like a dispersant. It breaks the oil up and tends to make it more accessible to the forces of nature in it.
Have you had to pull back any boats off the water because of this weather at this point?
I don't know. I know we have standards above which we will not operate. We have people in the field to make sure that we're operating safely. And also the cloudiness and the fog of the morning slows down the flights. But I don't have any specific information as to how many boats have not gone.
So what you said about 39 skimmers may not actually be the case today because of the weather.
Well, the weather that I was quoting to you was in the Gulf, where we're not skimming in the Gulf, we're skimming in the Sound. And to my knowledge, the weather today has not hampered skimming operations, but nobody has come up and told me that.
Alaska just held a press conference, and they said that Exxon was pulling in its skimmers because of the bad weather.
Well, then they have information that I don't have. I'm just telling you all that I know up to this point.
Mr. Cornett?
Yes?
Some fishermen in Cordova told me that rather than sign contracts with Exxon to work at your effort on the spill, they would get some dewatering pumps themselves, and they were going to go out and collect oil. Do you intend to buy that back from them? if they deliver it to you?
I would have to cross that bridge at that time.
It's right now to do that?
You're telling me something I don't know.
What are you going to do with that skimmed oil? There was a wire service report that it's still good to make roads out of or something? Is that what Exxon's going to do with it?
Normally what you do with it is if you get it up off the water, you can put it into a processing plant and just take the water out of it and it's crude again. You can make gasoline or anything else out of it.
Excuse me, what's that oil worth, by the way, a gallon? How much is that oil worth?
It's worth a little less than the crude that comes out of the pipeline because it has to be processed some more, so that lowers the value.
Has somebody else been and brought back to you? Is it worth the same as the crude that comes out of the pipeline?
I would think so.
Do you have any estimate of how much Exxon has spent to date and how much it's likely to spend on cleaning up the spill?
I don't have it. It's a large and growing number, but I don't.
Hundreds of millions, tens of millions.
I don't know, tens of millions probably at this point. Yes.
Have you provided any reimbursement to the state to support its operating expenses in advance of some final settlement that you expect to make with the state?
I don't know where that stands, but I have given a verbal commitment to the state that if they will let us know what they need and some sort of a form of accounting that we can go back and reconcile at the end, that we will either advance money to the state to keep their cash flow going, or they can keep track of it as they go and send it to us like a bill and we'll pay it promptly. But yes, we have committed to do it. I just don't know where the mechanism stands today. There's a lot of, in a lot of these things, there's a lot of grinding that goes on between the expression of your good intention and actually getting it into somebody's hand, and we're finding that in a lot of areas, but I guess that's to be expected. Yes, sir.
There was a lot of news over the weekend about a record jump in the price of gasoline. Is Exxon passing on the cost of this cleanup to the American consumer?
At this point, we're not passing it along to anybody, but in the normal course of things in any business, the expenses that you incur are deductible on your income tax, and if it gets to the consumer, that will be where it gets, how it gets there. Any other questions?
Are you beginning to get a general idea of how much would be claimed from fishermen and others who have had losses because of this accident?
I don't think we've even seen the real beginning of it yet. We've had 400 claims, and we're just now beginning to get money out on the street because, as I said, it takes a lot of grinding in between expression of your good intentions and actually getting it, all the mechanisms worked out to where people can take advantage of it. I don't think it takes a little while for the trust level to build up too. People don't really want to believe that they can walk in and you're going to write them a check and you walk out. And they walk out. Yes.
How many checks have you actually issued? I understand some checks were issued in Cordova for emergency assistance. Can you tell us how many checks have been issued and to what amounts?
Okay, I'll let Don speak about the claims. We have, I believe, issued a check for $1 million to the city of Seward and $500,000 to Kodiak Okay, you want to answer that question?
We advanced $250,000 to the Cordova District Fishermen United. That was yesterday.
That's Don Marsden.
We've had several people in Cordova come and talk to us about placing their claims, and we gave them the instructions, told them about our plans, and are willing to sit down with them again and talk to them. That's about where it stands.
Have you given $1 million to the aquaculture?
Yes, we have.
You have a lot of fishermen and fishing boats working for you. If the fishermen file a claim for lost earnings from fishing, will their income in working for the spill be counted against their claim for losses in fishing?
No.
When you do settle a claim, are you...
Let me go back. You're talking about Cordova.
I'm talking about all the fishermen that has been hired to work in the cleanup effort who are making...
No. The answer is still no.
When you settle a claim with a fisherman, are you asking the fisherman... waiver of future liability arising from the claim, or what are the mechanics between you saying you're settling on the one hand and any legal rights that the fishermen may wish to pursue through the legal system at a later date?
It really depends upon the situation that you're presented with. But I have been telling the fishermen, their organizations, that we are taking partial settlements, okay? That we may close out, say, 1989, but we're leaving open 1990 and beyond.
If you're settling 1989, are you asking them to sign a waiver of all claims arising from, say, the 1989 season then?
No, we're being very specific as to the releases we're taking. They will come in and tell us what their claim is and what they want left open, and we are adhering to their wishes and leaving those claims open. It's a step-by-step process that we're taking in this, and eventually we will reach after three or four or five or six steps in settling the entire claim down the road.
Will you take claims from out-of-state fishermen who fish Prince William Sound?
Yes.
You're listening to Don Marsden, who's the claim manager for Exxon.
Any other questions on claims?
Go ahead.
Over the weekend, Exxon had pending with the Coast Guard a request to use chemical dispersants in the Gulf of Alaska. What is the status of that? Have you dropped it now that the weather has turned apparently for the more favorable out in the Gulf?
It's my understanding it's pending.
Do you intend to pursue it?
If we get permission.
You still want the permission?
It's my understanding we do.
Any idea when you'll hear?
No.
Yes. It appears that Exxon was not mounting any effort at the leading edge of the slick around Gore Point and south of the Kenai Peninsula. In light of the change in weather that may be dispersing the oil naturally, is Exxon relieved that the weather is going to do what Exxon was not doing?
We are grateful for the breaks we get on this. Any other questions?
This is a claims question. Are you accepting any claims from, say, cannery workers?
Don Marsden is returning.
Most definitely. We have talked to several of the processors, and they are cooperating with us. And we are trying to get to the people that are suffering losses and try to provide them with emergency assistance to carry them over when they're having this hardship.
And seasonal workers, again, would also be eligible for that, people, migrant workers who come up, college students who normally come up and work the canneries. They all
yes, and that's the information that the processors are providing us, so we don't have John Smith from somewhere that never came up here before making a claim against us.
You have to prove that they were previously employed.
That's correct.
The turnover is extremely high in the shore workers in the fishing industry. Is there any way you're going to try to weed out the people who wouldn't have come and those who were coming for the first time, for instance, or fishermen who had intentions of coming for the first time to finish had just bought a permit but had no demonstrated track record? How are you going to handle that?
We're aware of the problem. We're going to give special consideration to those cases that you've just mentioned, and I've told those people that we would take it on an individual basis and see what can be worked out. Yes, sir.
I want to try and clear up two discrepancies. Exxon says there's no oil leaking from the ship, but yesterday the state of Alaska said there was a sheen around the ship and the boom didn't appear to be holding. The second discrepancy, if I could clear it up, the Coast Guard said this morning, just a couple hours ago, that only 1,000 barrels a day of oil was being cleaned up. Exxon says 2,800 barrels a day. Can you clear those two things up?
Not till I get back to the office. This is the information I'm given on that. But on the sheen around the ship, maybe. You want to come in?
I can clear up one of them. Okay. I was at the press conference Saturday with the Admiral, and I think he was being conservative. He estimated that we would pick up 1,000. I saw the board Saturday. We were hoping to pick up 1,500. We actually picked up 2,000 that day, and we picked up like 2,300 yesterday, so that the difference in the numbers is just the factual data on what we picked up.
Okay, John, you want to talk about the ship leaking?
John Tompkin of the salvage team.
The sheen around the ship, what we found happening is as the boats are alongside the vessel,
and undertaking the diving activity, they may occasionally scrape against the vessel, and the turbulence of the diving and that scraping will end up having a little piece of oil or something that may come off the ship, and you could end up getting a sheen undertaken. We flew over it yesterday on two occasions, and it was sheen noted, but that's our best assessment as to whether how a sheen could occur and what we have been able to see in the past. But we're confident that there isn't any oil leaking from the vessel.
Fate said that the boom was hanging up on the bow of the Exxon Valdez due to winds or other conditions. You didn't notice that?
Yes, sometimes the wind will bring the boom up close on the bow, and there was one occasion when it did hang up, and what we end up doing is having that tended so that the boom is laying properly.
The bow of a tanker tends to go underwater and then stick out like a nose, and there's a real tendency for it to run up on there. You have to tend the booms with a boat to keep it in shape. Okay, did our bird lady arrive? All right. Thank you very much.
Don Cornett, the operations manager for Alaska for Exxon, concluding this press conference. We heard from a variety of Exxon personnel, some we met for the first time. John Tompkins is with Exxon Shipping Company and is involved in the salvage efforts. And we also heard from Don Marsden, who's the Exxon claims manager on the scene here in Valdez. Monty Taylor also spoke briefly. Monty Taylor, a familiar face to Junoites over the years, worked for Exxon, was Don Cornett's predecessor. The statements we heard today, status report from Exxon, about 15 to 17,000 barrels of oil still on board the ship. Most of that oil either in safe compartments that were not holed during the grounding. There is, however, a sheen of oil or a layer of oil on top of water in the damaged compartments. They're working on skimming that off now before the vessel is completely repaired. We heard that there was some controversy among press members, but about 2,300 barrels, 2,300 barrels a day is the goal for the skimmers. Some 18,000 barrels of oil have been recovered. Some 39 skimmers are at work. There are 200,000 feet of boom. Communications has been raised as an ongoing problem for the workers out in the field in Prince William Sound. There's a joint communication center being established, pooling resources from the state, Coast Guard, and Exxon. That should be in place probably by, or is that early next week? Elements are being worked on now. Salvage inspection is continuing. They mentioned that an additional 500 Alaskan hires are expected in the next 7 days. There are about 1,000 contract workers now, including both worker crews and crews on board boats. One note by Don Cornett of Exxon is that all the manpower that can be used currently is mobilized and is in hand. They've received about 400 claims requests so far. We also heard from, again, Don Marsden, the claims manager, regarding some of the questions about claims, clarifying what waivers and such people have to sign, and the fact that Exxon individually works out claims with each claimant. There was some controversy by press members about conflicting figures from Coast Guard and DEC briefings. One question regarded the effect of weather on the skimmers. There are 39 skimmers out, according to Exxon operations. The weather in the Gulf of Alaska is picking up, wind blowing at about 35 knots. However, in Prince William Sound, the conditions are not that dramatic. And so far as Exxon knows or says, the skimmers are in operation. There was evidently a report at an earlier DEC meeting this morning that said some of the skimmers may be coming in. Again, about 2,300 barrels a day is the estimate for oil recovery. About 40% of the 240,000 barrels originally spilled is estimated to have evaporated or dispersed to this point. 18,000 barrels have been recovered. That's still less than 1% of the oil. And about, well, a small amount has been burned or otherwise collected, which leaves about 60% of the original spill still at large, and that's divided equally or evenly between the shoreline, Prince William Sound, and the Gulf of Alaska, the North Gulf Coast. At this point, there are no other press conferences scheduled for today. We will be trying to get a briefing by DEC tomorrow if one is scheduled, and also any further Exxon briefings, any briefings by DEC, the Coast Guard, the NTSB, or other organizations. We will be advising stations down the line. One other note was that the Exxon Valdez is undergoing the salvage repair work. Surveys have been completed. They're in the middle of analyzing the actual effects and impacts, and expect to begin the repair work and may have the vessel moving in a matter of weeks rather than months. I want to thank KCHU and Talkeetna Community Radio volunteer Tricia King for her assistance in this broadcast. Engineering back at the KCHU studios is James Winchester. Also, I'd like to acknowledge that continuing coverage of the Exxon Valdez oil spill and cleanup has been made possible in part by an emergency grant from the City of Valdez and listener contributions. We'll be back from the Valdez Civic Center or the Valdez City Council Chambers or wherever the next press conference is scheduled. I'm Dave Hammack, and this is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network. This is Dave Hammack at the Valdez Civic Center Ballroom. We're standing by for the start of a National Wildlife Federation press conference. We'll be broadcasting this conference in Valdez and Cordova via KCHU radio. Cameras are here, and they've been testing their white balance and getting ready to start, and now the conference is underway. Well, it's getting underway.
Good afternoon. My name is Jay Hayer, spelled H-A-I-R. I am president of the National Wildlife Federation, Washington, D.C. For your background information, the National Wildlife Federation is the nation's largest private conservation education organization with over 5 million members and supporters. For the last several days, my colleagues and I have been traveling in the Prince William Sound area, visiting with a number of individuals affected by this tragic oil spill. And today I would like to announce four of several major actions the National Wildlife Federation will be taking on over the next several weeks and months. To characterize perhaps what we have found, particularly in places other than Valdez, and we've spent the last couple of days in Cordova, a fishing town of about 2,500 residents, almost all of whom are directly or indirectly, depending upon the fishing, commercial fishing in the Prince William Sound area. When we arrived in Cordova on Sunday evening, we were greeted at the Reluctant Fisherman Inn with the following sign. It says, "The flags are at half mast due to the death of our environment." Outside was a mermaid statue overlooking the harbor that had a black ribbon tied on her arm. On the wall of the local restaurant were several pieces of paper from the years that people had taken a poll on when the great herring poll for guessing the date of the opening of the herring fishing season. For that one, which was for the 1989 great herring pool, were the following words: March 24th, 1989, the fat lady sung a death song. Her name was Exxon. We met that evening with an overcapacity crowd of citizens from Cordova who expressed in a variety of ways their feelings for what had happened to their lifestyle. As you have experienced from people here or places you've been, there is an enormous amount of fear, anxiety, or what's going to happen to their lives personally and ultimately to the rehabilitation of Prince William Sound. The four things that I mentioned at the beginning of this statement are the following that we will be doing today. We are sending from Washington, D.C. letters to the appropriate congressional committees, both in the House and the Senate, to conduct field oversight hearings. There will be numerous hearings, as you could imagine, back in Washington, D.C. We want those members of Congress to come to Prince William Sound, to go to places like Cordova, to go to places like Seward, Kodiak, and Valdez, so that those individuals most directly affected by this tragedy will be able to come and testify. And that's important both from what it cost to go to Washington, D.C., as well as the summer being the busiest period of the year, as you know, for Alaskans to earn a livelihood. The second thing that we will be calling for is for President Bush to establish a presidential commission on the Prince William Sound oil spill disaster. That commission would be, as our recommendation would go forward, comprised of distinguished Americans who could come, who could receive testimony, who would be supported with the appropriate technical and scientific expertise in order to make a recommendation back to the President and ultimately to the Congress of the United States on ways to ensure that this kind of a disaster never happens again. The third area that we will be doing, either through a series of court actions we plan to file, or hopefully through the sense of corporate responsibility of Exxon, is a request that the Exxon company establish a multi-billion dollar Prince William Sound trust fund. Multi-billion dollar Prince William Sound trust fund, not millions. You may be aware that Exxon is an extremely large corporation, the second largest in the world. Over the 10-year period that the Trans-Alaskan pipelines have been open, the Exxon Corporation's total corporate profits have been $49.6 billion, almost $5 billion a year. It's our view that those who take public resources like oil and convert them into private wealth have a profound and absolute responsibility to make the investments to protect the public's interest and to protect the interest, protect the environment before those revenues are used to pay multi-million dollar corporate salaries, buy corporate jets, or distributed to shareholders. The fourth action that we will be taking this week, and working with a number of individual citizens here in the Prince William Sound area and a number of organizations that are both conservation organizations and commercial and sport fishing organizations, is sending a letter to the President, which will be sent directly to Mr. Bush and printed as a full-page advertisement in the Washington Post on Thursday. And I'd like to conclude by reading you the text of that open letter. Mr. President, please come to Alaska to see personally our nation's worst environmental disaster. President Carter went to Three Mile Island. Prime Minister Gandhi went to Bhopal. General Secretary Gorbachev went to Chernobyl during those terrible tragedies. Your people are hurting. They are angry at the senseless environmental destruction which the oil industry promised would never happen. The livelihoods of thousands of Americans have been seriously threatened by the great Alaskan oil spill. Please, Mr. President, come to Cordova, Kodiak, Seward, Valdez, and other fishing towns and villages. See for yourself the economic and environmental havoc caused by an oil industry not prepared to deal with this disaster. The Prince William Sound tragedy cannot be understood from the White House horseshoe pit. You cannot delegate this responsibility. You need to walk the oil-soaked beaches, have your nostrils filled with the stench of toxic petroleum fumes, and see personally the thousands of dead and dying animals. You need to see the grief of the people, many of whom have no more tears left to cry. A president serious about environmental protection would want to see this disaster firsthand. If you did, you would understand why it is not possible to prudently develop the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, Bristol Bay, and other sensitive areas at this time. Mr. President, we desperately need a national energy policy that emphasizes conservation and renewable source of energy, not continued addiction to fossil fuels. Mr. Bush, we urgently need your presence and personal leadership. During the presidential campaign, you went to Boston Harbor. As president, you went to Japan to Hirohito's funeral. Why didn't you come to this one? Please come to Alaska. See personally America's worst economic and environmental tragedy. As our president, our leader, your response is awaited. With that, I will conclude my formal remarks. And if there are time for a few questions, I've got to catch a helicopter with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation in a few seconds to tour some other areas in the sound we've not yet been to. So, if there are questions, please.
Yes. Only about 100 or so questions, but just to begin with, could you give us your general impressions, having toured the affected area? Perhaps you could do it by comparing this with other ecological disasters of recent history. A brief description of what you've seen and a comparison. How bad is it, in your opinion?
Well, I would characterize this one as a classic example of the disease of corporate greed, where we have been promised, we've been hoodwinked, we were told by Exxon, Alyeska, the major producers here, and transporters here in Alaska, that this disaster could never have happened. If you read the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Contingency Plan, they even state in there they couldn't envision an accident in which in excess of 200,000 barrels would ever be dumped into Prince William Sound. Why couldn't they envision that if you had tankers like the Exxon Valdez carrying 1.3 billion barrels? My specific reaction to your question is that from what we've seen, this is an example of where nobody's in charge, everybody's in charge, and the kinds of responses that needed to happen early on to contain this disaster simply were not in place. We need to have a complete revision of this kind of a contingency plan and a complete revision of how we're going to respond to it and put one person in charge. And immediately, when another tanker goes on Bligh Reef, and it will, it's just a matter of time, immediately the corporation responsible is moved out of the area of responsibility and you bring in a public figure responsible for that. And I think if we do that, then we'll be able to contain the spill. My recommendation would, in a case like this, would have been to immediately offload personnel on the Exxon Valdez, the local citizens affected by the fire, and to torch the Exxon Valdez in place.
How about terrorism? Could you characterize the degree of environmental harm that you feel has been done by this? Perhaps you could do it by comparing it to other ecological disasters.
Well, we were very actively involved in some of the follow-up activities and trying to establish working relationships with Soviet scientists in Chernobyl. And there's no doubt in my mind that the long-term environmental consequences of the Prince William Sound oil spill will far exceed those of Chernobyl or Bhopal. They were serious, obviously. In Bhopal, thousands of people were killed or injured permanently. But in here, you really have destroyed an environmental system that probably is one of the most pristine in all of North America. I think it's probably fair to say that in our lifetimes, everyone in this room, we will never see Prince William Sound the way it was on March 23rd, 1989.
What do you consider the to save a few birds and a few waters? Is that a valid gesture on their part?
As a scientist myself, in terms of the impact on the population of either oil, the marine mammals affected, particularly otters, or the number of species of birds, you're not going to have any measurable effect on the long-term population viability of any of the species involved. But there's another very important side to this. People demand, people expect, they have a right to expect to try to save all those animals that have been impacted. And I think that that's going to have to continue to foreseeable future. Massive mortality rates, the number of otters that will be successfully rehabilitated and released will be de minimis. And there'll have to be major management efforts to reestablish populations in those areas once there's a food chain reestablished that can sustain those species in those areas. But the public would absolutely, and they should be, outraged by this if those kinds of actions were not taken. I could say that the same kind of futile effort is being made by Exxon going around and soaking up and polishing rocks with oil on them. In the long haul, that's not going to remove a significant amount of oil from Prince William Sound. In the long haul, the only way it's going to be removed is through that kind of action, skimming action, but ultimately nature's going to have to resolve the problem. And that's going to take years, not decades, to do. There's a question over here. Perhaps not.
With regard to the requests that you've made, your 4 points that you made in your opening statement, naturally, in any kind of negotiation, you go in demanding as much as you possibly can envision, hoping perhaps for salvaging something out of what you have asked for. I wonder, with that in mind, if you could perhaps nail down what you think is most important from a practical point of view of the things that you have requested. Is it most important to have President Bush come here? From a practical point of view, would it be most important to have congressional hearings here? What would you give most emphasis to?
Well, I would say from a very pragmatic political point of view, I think it's absolutely embarrassing that the president has not personally visited the nation's worst environmental disaster. Now, I cannot in my wildest imagination wonder why that hasn't happened. You know, two scenarios that come to mind is Alaska, because of its few electoral votes, so unimportant that the president couldn't come, or is it because George Bush's ties to the oil industry are so strong and so historic that he has personally been unwilling to come and confront the disaster that an industry he came out of has caused? Mr. Bush, I believe, if he came and saw it, because I know George Bush, he's a very decent individual. He is committed to the environment. I believe if he saw this, he would change his mind very rapidly about going into sensitive areas like the Arctic Refuge in the future. I think the most important thing that has to happen over the next several months is for this issue not to get lost from the view of the public. And there are several ways of doing that. The president, wherever he goes, is going to make news. That's important. Members of Congress coming here, listening to the people, are going to understand more and also make news. But as we go through the next several months of deliberations in Washington, various people trying to sort out what happens, the American people, I think, are as angry, because we get hundreds of letters and phone calls, are as angry as I've ever seen them in the last 10 years that I've been actively involved in this kind of activity of environmental protection. They're going to want to demand major changes. If there's any good that could come out of this beyond the restoration of Prince William Sound, the good is that the American people will demand that we now finally, as we approach the 21st century, establish a national energy policy. That's the good. I've got to go shortly, so I'm getting the high sign back there, but go ahead. Yes, back there.
What exactly did you have in mind for the multi-billion dollar fund that you suggest Exxon establish? And also, could you go a little farther on your intimation that you might have to sue Exxon to get them to establish that?
Well, I think Exxon has responsibilities to Prince William Sound for as long as it takes. I'm fearful that Exxon, once the oil sheens are off the water, once the dead otter and other species of wildlife have been picked up, and once the tankers are floating again full speed down the Valdez Strait, we'll say, hey, we did it, it's over with. Well, it's not over with. It's not over with until Prince William Sound is returned to its pristine condition. And I want them to, in essence, put a bond up, put a trust up, not of which they are the stewards of, but which you have trustees that are representative of people here affected by it. For example, what's going to happen to the herring fishing fleet in Cordova? Not this year. They've already lost their $1 million fishers this year. What's going to happen 5, 6, 10 years from now? One of the fears that they have with the high school age children in Cordova, the real serious fear and anguish caused by the very simple question, are we now going to be able to go to college? Are we going to be able to get an education? The answer, I think, has to be that Exxon has to guarantee them that those kinds of opportunities for education and economic development are not going to be lost simply because Exxon walks away from it. I'll be honest with you, I don't trust Exxon. This is a classic example of big oil and big lie. They told us in the middle 70s it couldn't happen at Valdez, it did. They're telling us now with a multi-million dollar media campaign they've done a great job at Prudhoe Bay, and they're absolutely lying. We have released a report to Congress called Oil in the Arctic. It has shown that there are numerous violations to the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act in Prudhoe Bay, the North Slope of Alaska. The EPA has done the very same kind of analysis. And why would you ever trust them again after those two big lies? Either to comply with safe transport of oil down Valdez Strait, or ever to go into the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge Bristol Bay and other sensitive areas in this state. You simply don't. Yes, sir.
Can you make a comparison between the oil spill in Bhopal and Chernobyl? Could you repeat that statement again?
I don't know what I said. I'll repeat a statement. I hope it'll be consistent with that. The Prince William Sound oil spill, in my view, from an environmental point of view, is every bit as serious as where the Union Carbide disaster in Bhopal, where thousands of Indians were either killed or permanently maimed, or the nuclear disaster in Chernobyl. Those issues that I just mentioned, Bhopal and Chernobyl, were much easier contained. In terms of long-term environmental ramifications, the Prince William Sound disaster has to rank as not only this country's, but probably one of the world's greatest environmental disasters ever. We'll have this problem to deal with for the rest of our lives. Okay. Anything else? Gotta go. Thank you very much.
And those are the concluding remarks by Jay Hare, who is the president of the National Wildlife Federation of Washington, D.C. That organization described by Mr. Hare as the largest private conservation education organization in the country. Briefly, he described the efforts of he and his people in spending several days in investigating the Prince William Sound area and meetings in Cordova. He mentioned four action items that the National Wildlife Federation is considering. One, that they'll be sending letters from their D.C. office to appropriate congressional offices requesting that the appropriate congressional committees hold field oversight hearings. Mr. Hare stressing his feeling that the Congress needs to come to places like Valdez, Cordova, Kodiak, Seward, and hold hearings here to really assess the impact on the communities and people in those communities. Also, a second action item on the National Wildlife Federation agenda is to encourage President Bush to establish a presidential commission on the Prince William Sound oil spill disaster to meet, hold hearings, to make recommendations to both the President and eventually to Congress on what needs to be done to prevent any further such oil spills or disasters in the Sound. Mr. Hare also promised court action, or at least heavy political pressure, court action if needed, to force Exxon to establish a multi-billion dollar trust fund for Prince William Sound rehabilitation. Again, multi-billion dollar. This item being justified because of the need for the long approach and for the long commitment to organize the rehabilitation. And finally, a coalition of groups is sending an open letter to President Bush that will be published, I guess, early next week in the Washington Post. An open letter encouraging, as a plea to President Bush, to come to the site of the disaster, citing that you cannot delegate this responsibility, and saying that a president serious about environmental conservation and preservation should be here to see the effects of the oil spill firsthand. In response to questions by some of the press members present, some very strong statements on the part of Jay Hare, president of the National Wildlife Federation, about his not trusting the oil industry, Exxon in particular, and the need for legislation to be put in place to take control of any future oil spills immediately away from the owner company and place it under the control of a public official responsive to the local needs. Again, strong language from the National Wildlife Federation, not unanticipated, regarding the efforts by Exxon to clean up and the efforts by the industry to put the best face on the issue. That about wraps up this press conference. We do have a notice that tomorrow, Holland America West Tours is holding a news conference. Holland America evidently working with the Prince William Sound Tourism Coalition to develop their own fund to work in the cleanup of the Sound. There's a press conference tomorrow afternoon at 1:30. We'll try to broadcast that for you. And any other press briefings or meetings that we're informed of, we'll try to get on the air, or at least get reports of them to you. I want to thank KCHU and Talkeetna Radio, our community radio volunteer, Tricia King, for her assistance in this broadcast. James Winchester and or Mary Beth Lomax are back at KCHU. I'm Dave Hammack. Continuing coverage of the Exxon Valdez oil spill and cleanup has been made possible in part by an emergency grant from the City of Valdez and listener contributions. From the Valdez Civic Center Ballroom, I'm Dave Hammack, and this is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.